Tantra Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Mountain Crown by Karen Lawachi, narrated by Julianne Irons. Even the air around Fortune City tasted dirty. Mega felt it like a mucus of smoke and waste on the flat of her tongue. She spat on the deck of the river barge. The mountain guard who'd climbed aboard to check the papers of the passengers watched her do it, his lips curling with a familiar disdain. She'd witnessed the same expression on the crew of the whaling ship that had brought her north to this island that was once her home, as if she no longer belonged in the land of her ancestors. She didn't look away from the guard, and he approached with the stiff-legged swagger of a typical Katakin. His energetic presence was a hollow clang to her, an empty bucket struck by the hammer of the cosmos. The infestation of Katakins to pursue and land created ceaseless echoes of nothingness. Even the wind carried a fervor of life that Katakins lacked. She had not felt such absence among so much living nature in 10 years. Despite her parents' warning before she embarked on this journey, the absence was nearly impossible to tolerate, as was the condescension and arrogance from people like this mountain guard. His sun-lined eyes roved from her shorn hair to the gray-dappled Suan scales stitched into the woolen fox fur collar of her coat. His gaze lingered on the rifle slung on her shoulder. "You plan to use that bastard?" "No." Her people were not prone to violence, but this was not a language Katakins understood. He grunted and continued his staring assessment of her attire. She was the only Basuan aboard the barge. All the other passengers were the same ilk of desperate homeless, hoping for a better opportunity in the gold fields or in town. The clog of boats along the river, both steam and paddle of every size and craftsmanship, seemed unceasing in its traffic. So many foolish individuals hoping to strike it rich, or exploit one another, or perhaps with little inclination to find another path. She was now a part of the throng, not for the gold, but for the Suan, though perhaps no less foolish for the journey, no matter how necessary the right. The guard waved his hands at the chains crisscrossed over her chest. "What are those for?" "I could show you, but I'd need to call one of those Suan closer." Four of the creatures circled overhead in muted ellipses, dull shadows against the canvas sack color of the sky. Dragons, the Katakins called them, but they were Suan. Creatures of fire to the Basuan. Perhaps these Suan were wild, but the proximity to Fortune City and the subdued waves around them told Mega they were probably enslaved to the gold like the indentured people digging below. They were no threat. They barely disturbed her senses for how tethered they were to the work of these Katakins. But the guard glanced upward quickly, as if one of them could breathe flames into his head at any moment. He caught her watching his reaction and flicked a hand at the black twin blades hitched to her belt. "And those?" She stated the obvious. "I'm Basuan. These are Basuan blades. If there is some sort of law against them, you're welcome to try to take them from me." He was armed, a pistol in a holster on his belt, his navy woolen jacket, a ragged testimony to the weather he endured here during harsher months. He squinted into her eyes as if he expected her to look away. She didn't. This was not a Katakin used to taking the initiative. He seemed to come to a temperate conclusion and held out his hand. "Papers." She delivered them from the pouch at the front of her coat. He read through both sheets, front and back, staring a heartbeat longer at the stamps issued by his Katakin government and the attached card from the government of the Southern Isle from which she'd traveled. Both supposedly gave her permission to cross the border, but she had known coming here for the first time since the end of the war that there was no telling what agreements would stand. She had volunteered for the seasonal rite to allow her this access, rather than her parents or anyone else in the family Suan Kang. It was time she saw their land with her adult eyes, instead of with the emotional vision of the dream that plagued her. A dream like this was a message from the cosmos, and she had no choice but to follow its path in order to glean the meaning. "Where are you coming from?" said the guard, even as he read the papers. "That is the stamp of Mazmor. And why are you here?" He held her permit in his hand, but she answered anyway. "To gather Suan." You know you can't use your bastard magic in Kataka around our people. I'm aware. Where you aim to get 'em?
She looked pointedly toward the Crown Mountains, looming in jagged majesty beyond the hills and plateaus around Fortune City.
How you gonna get there?
The most expedient course would be to hire a horse.
You ain't allowed to fly those dragons back.
It was an entire other protocol to register a gathered Suon, and he must have known that. Just like he knew the answers to everything else he asked her. So she didn't bother to answer him again. They were paranoid about the wild Suon with reason. On the borders of Fortune City stood wooden tower emplacements for iron cannons aimed to the sky. His gaze flitted toward them, then looked all around the deck of the barge, the crates wrapped in rope and oiled canvases, and the 24 other passengers milling about. Another mountain guard moved among them, asking for identification. He looked back at Mika.
Rifle.
She unslung it from her shoulder and handed it over, because pointing out the waste of time would only delay her further. He folded her papers and pocketed them, then seized the rifle in both of his hands, at stock and forestock. With perfunctory movements, he braced the butt of the weapon to his shoulder and sighted down the barrel. Then he angled it down and slid back the bolt. The rifle was unloaded. He seemed disappointed, as if she should have been breaking the law by carrying it live to the town. He locked it and passed the weapon back to her. She slung it back on her shoulder. He retrieved her papers from his pocket, looked at them, and looked at her. Then he held them out, as if she were somehow forcing him in this dance. With a twist of her lips, she accepted them, and he moved past her to the next passenger. She hauled up from her feet the lumpen bag of her supplies and draped it over the other shoulder. Another gust of gritty air brushed against her cheek, carrying the scent of mud and unwashed bodies. For Katakans, gold as both idea and allure alone defined the ambitiously named Fortune City, where nearly 10,000 dream-laden people pitted the wilderness banks like debris left behind by an army long decamped. Mika had come to this river mouth with her family in her childhood, when the terrain had been untouched, but she barely remembered it. She had been perhaps 5 years old the last time. Soon after, she and many other Basuan families were corralled into camps by the Katakans, who had settled this land by force. It was early summer, and the steam rose up off the wet land at the mouth of the Derish River. A delicate mist breathed over all the angled tents and crooked cabins hewn from green lumber. The flat facades of public emporiums were lined up along Shore Street, with their weathered, unswept lettering mimicking the decor of a civilization hundreds of miles away. It was a ghost town, not for the lack of population, but for the empty carousing that gripped these souls, hanging on to some semblance of a life remembered. Mika couldn't understand such a life. Her family had quit this land and its overseers after the war 10 years ago, so they didn't have to witness it. But the sky and the cosmos bore witness, as they had since creation, and rang with a stifled fury, the reverberations of which she felt in her Basuan blood. If her dream foretold some kind of reckoning for the imbalance, perhaps this journey would enlighten her to it. Overhead, the shades of low-flying Suon still spun, indistinguishable from the sadness of bondage to this town. This far north, the summer night sank to twilight blue, when the Suon yearned for pitch night and nests. The Suon got neither. She wanted to call them to her to soothe, but any outstretch toward them was met with fear, and she watched as they darted higher, further away from the river. A faint whistling of air fluted through their hollow scales as they sailed updrafts, with the mountains as backdrop. Once, these rangers had been free for both Suon and the Basuan. Her parents and their parents, stretching back as far as families remembered, had grown with the mountains and its life. Now only the highest peaks stood liberated from the greed and scrabble below, for no other reason than because the Katakan's need for gold could not tame them. Her boots sank in the sandbar up to her ankles as she made her way inland toward Shore Street. A bazaar of people hawked various wares from their decimated outfits. Shovels, pots and pans, long johns, even bread for the wealthy. The smell was irrepressible. Unwashed bodies and sawdust, piss and dogs, an exhausted horseflesh that quivered, untied by a log pile forgotten. The animal's presence passed through like a fog. She kept walking. The constant grind of the sawmills buzzed insistent against her ears, masking all of nature. Shore Street wasn't much of a street, as most of the ground was mud so thick, even the mules battled to take a step. Duckboards sagged in the soup of it, weighed by the constant shuffle of bodies milling before shops, gambling dens, dance halls and saloons, open at all hours. Sullen faces looked at her, but didn't see her. The nothingness of these katakas tried to stick to her like oil. She breathed shallow, so as to not imbibe their lives. She interrupted a line stretching across her path for 50 feet. The head of it disappeared somewhere in a small post office. People stood with barely enough space between them, and every few minutes they inched forward, as toward a lectern of judgment, their heads down, their hands pocketed. On the other side of the queue, a crowd spilled in a disorderly glut from twin doors held open by sheer numbers. Gusts of smoke expelled above their heads. From within, the bulbous sounds of indistinct voices swelled and burst in response to some action unseen from the street. I in the blood. I and you. She startled and looked up. Unlike the other buildings in the row, this wooden structure arched in a blackened dome above the roofs of its neighbors. Smoke billowed from narrow slats between beams. A rough-hewn sign hung above the doors, with the words emblazoned, Pit Dragon Emporium. Eye in the claw and you, blood in the tooth and blood in eyes. The wrongness of it jarred her like a finger shoving between her ribs, through her skin and muscle. All of the town receded like an ocean, sucked back into the gluttonous firmament of the clouds. She tasted cinder in her mouth, inside her nose. She shouldered her way through the clog. Once inside, the glaucoma white of daylight dimmed to near blindness. Incense smoke mingled with a sharper scent, something from the boil of the earth itself. The stink of Suan fear, imprisoned by the press of bodies. Torn wing and choke eye. Scream and burst, I blood and you. Her throat seized and she coughed to open it again. Between the long arms of diggers come in from the gold trenches, and tattered ex-soldiers with their uniform badges smeared by dirt, a woman sat by an overturned crate. On the top lay strips of dark salted meat. The woman hollered through the bodies, offering dragon cuts for a finger of coin. Meka swung away, swallowing rage with Suan rage pulsing toward her. I am blood and you and I, shadows and cry. She shoved deeper into the crowd. Hollow masks made of wood and shale hung from poles screwed into the tall walls. They resembled a child's version of a Suan face, haphazardly painted around the eyes with red and white. The onlookers separated slightly when she pushed closer to an iron cage erected in the center of the space, a skeleton in the dome shape of the emporium itself. Inside the cage, two Suan fought, tethered to chains that anchored their long necks. I in blood and I. She could not discern from which Suan came the impression. A blast of unseen waves crashed against her, and she flailed. She failed to touch either of them, all of her awareness ricocheting back to her in panic rebuff. The disturbance to nature nearly rocked her on her feet. A piebald cloud and a black Suan. They were adolescent in size, twice the height of a tall man when reared on their hindquarters. Their leathery wings were bound to their bodies by winch rope. Long jaws snapped at each other in ducking feint and leaping attack. Their golden eyes rolled and darted. Legs and flanks and whipping tails jarred the cage in the violence of the bout, and the crowd erupted in sounds of fear and excitement, the tumult echoing up to the rafters. Hands reached above the sea of heads, exchanging bills and bets. On the edges of the cage bars, blood slicked the iron like sweat, reflecting a dull crimson gleam. I in the blood and you in tooth. Gold shard. She looked toward the bursting impression of sunlight, incongruous in this pit. Near the iron plate bolted to the floorboards, with a chain slithering and rattling as the cloud Suan strained and jerked. A man with a wide-brimmed hat pulled low over his eyes, crouched and rocked on the pads of his feet. He was barefoot, skin blackened by soot. He paid no mind to anything but the fight. The ebony Suan struck the cloud Suan with a foretalon, and the cloud shrieked and stumbled. A barrage of incoherent pain pummeled against her, and Mika clamped around her own reaction, didn't bristle, a subtle attempt to soothe. Sweat trickled down the back of her neck, and nausea rose in her throat. The cloud Suan's chain cracked against wood and iron. The gold shard man flinched and made a hissing sound between his teeth, as if he felt the Suan's pain like she felt it, though no Katakan should. No Katakan should have ever felt so acutely of gold shard. They were hollow, soundless, a gouging instrument to all of nature. An image from her dream blared unbidden before her eyes. A yellow field of grass, and an incandescent sun making the entire world shimmer in its light. A man in the distance, his back to her, a halo of blood red around his shoulders. This man? I in blood, I in gold. I shiver and I... The shadows and noise of the pit swelled up around her once more. A pulsing echo from the piebald Suan, blood from its heart pumping its distress through the arteries of the earth. She stared as this man reached toward it. But instead of a left hand, he lightly tapped the iron bars with a leather-wrapped stump. The Suan's eyes rolled toward him, breath panting in hot gusts. It hunkered down near to his position on the other side of the cage, an unsteady rumble from the bottom of its throat like rockfall in an avalanche. He stroked the long neck with the edge of his handless wrist. Onlookers closest around the cage began to bang on it with tin cups and broken shovel handles. Two men standing on the opposite side took hold of the chain that bound the black Suan and heaved to pull it back from the cloud, which had fallen to its side and blew labored air like a bellows. More gashes showed along its skin ribs where scales should have been. The black roared, muzzle peeled back, its molten dark tongue fluttered in the heated air. Tendrils of smoke eked from flared nostrils. It only had one fang. Mika turned and elbowed her way out. The screams of the Suan pierced her eardrum still, and racketed in her mind like a gale. The edges of her sight dimmed even, standing once more under the cold white sky. She tried to breathe clean, but everywhere smelled of Katakan stink and despair. A melange of sensations and images melted behind her eyes, crawled over her skin. Golden eye lingered like a corona around the edges of it all. That man, his shared energy with the Suan, the impossibility of him like reaching up and feeling the burn of the stars. She moved before she realized she was moving, battling the conflicting urges to return to the Emporium and run away from it before she immolated. She trudged through the oily mud until she found herself in a saloon and leaned at the bar for a rice beer. The same here as in Mazmur, as in all towns of a certain size. The murky familiarity of the scene grounded her with some steadiness. She balanced against the seating. Here she could focus on simple realities. Watery alcohol, but she'd drink it anyway. In the corner, a white-haired fellow plied piano keys, half of which were missing. He rocked to the side and smiled at her, his grin as gap-toothed as the instrument. The room pressed in on her, barely 15 feet at its widest point. The walls smoke-stained, the floorboards dredged with dirt, sawdust, and eggshells. Voices caroled behind her with oblivious revelry, and she blinked slowly down at the foggy amber of her drink, finding some false fortune in its depths. She was so absorbed in the narrow focus of the glass that she didn't feel a thing, until another woman leaned beside her and asked the bartender for a shot. Then she spoke to Mika in a dialect of the western families of the Basuan. The sound of her in Mika's mind was a slow susurration, faint but present, like distant waves. A strange relief. She asked Mika if she had just arrived in Fortune City. Came straight to the saloon. A lie, so she needn't describe the Pit Dragon Emporium. One required a drink to deal with Katakans, with what she'd just witnessed. She looked at the woman and recognized the visages of her people and the dark eyes and saturnine expression. Harsh lines scored the woman's cheeks and slashed across her forehead like a washing cloth wrung of all moisture. Her hair hung long and stringy, not shaved and clean, and she wore the clothing of a Gatakan miner, corduroy shoulders, and the straight plain edges of labor denim. At her waist sat a single blade, not the twin of their people. Perhaps the blade wasn't even her own, and this woman had never completed a rite of gathering. For all Mekanu, this Basuan in Katakan garb had stolen it in dishonor. The thought coiled snake-like in Meka's belly.
You work in the valley?
The woman tossed back her shot.
The Gold Kings require dragons, and the dragons require bastards to be their dragoneers.
So she was the one who spoke to the Suan that winged above the town. The ones who fled in fear at the touch of a Basuan. Small wonder if this woman was the extent of their acquaintance.
You call them your kings? Meka said. And dragons?
She got a dismissive wave in reply.
I see your Suan scales, and you think because you left your home paths that you can come back to mine and judge me?
The woman was already half drunk. Who knew how long she'd been sitting in this saloon? Meka turned away and motioned to the barkeep to top up her glass.
Whatever you desire, sister. Working with the Suan keeps them out of the pit.
She drank, eyes on the back bar.
Not all of them. They were in the war. There's nothing for them but the pit. They are battle-caught.
She looked at the woman again. So this was what they told themselves. The Basuan who served the gold towns.
Were you in the war?
The woman grunted and hunched over her shot glass as if to protect it. The hum of their connection prickled now like static electricity.
You're too young to remember. My family was in the camps.
For 10 years.
Then you were fortunate. Though I hear it's worse living in Mazamor with their dirty magic.
No worse than here in the absence of it. The woman didn't answer or look at her. She picked up her glass and wandered off as if some remote voice called to her. Meka turned and peered at the mirror of the back bar, seeing it all at once. It was chipped black in places, with a couple of bullet holes and cobwebs of cracks spidering upward. Some of the murky green and brown glass bottles were layered in thin films of dust. On the shelf, a tiny rocking horse made of black soapstone. Antler bone the length of her arm. When she looked again into the mirror, a shadow in the shape of a man stood directly behind her. But the longer she watched, the more indistinct he became. She turned around but saw nothing, only the carousing Katakans and that Basuan woman at a corner table, staring at her. The door to the saloon swung, as if some sudden wind from the inside had gusted it open. She looked back at the Basuan woman. In the duration of moments between her sighting the shadow in the mirror and the movement at the door, all sound had disappeared, as though suctioned out of the world by a massive explosion.
Did you see who that was? She asked the Basuan.
Her own voice sounded tinny, despite her pitching it to bridge the distance between them, to be heard above the ringing piano.
Be grateful you didn't, said the woman, looking down at her drink, shoulders bowed.
A cold sank through Meka's skin and settled in her chest.
What do you mean by that?
But the other Basuan woman didn't answer. When Meka emerged from the saloon, the sky above had deepened to stone blue and faded to a burnt and angry orange behind the western mountain peaks, casting them in silhouette like an illuminated shadow box. The city sounded louder and cavernous in the northern light. All the chatter, laughter, and music spilled directionless from various saloons and parlors up and down the muddy thoroughfare. Deep between buildings were alleyways forged bitter shadows. Summer dropped hard with the sinking of the sun. She thought of hiring a horse to quit this town at the fastest possible speed, but a silence from the direction of the pit dome told her the fights had ended. She couldn't feel the Suan and could not walk on from them. Exposed once again to the sky, the remembrance of the piebald screams came to her in phantom echoes. She walked behind the venue. Its doors were shut now,
with a sign swung around to tell of the next bout in the morning. She found the stables where the Suan were kept. Idling outside of it was the man with the stump. Goldshard Ayanai. The soft slipping whisper of the Suan emanated from inside the stables. In the relative quiet of the man's presence, she felt blood red mingled in it like a stain. A strange combination if it weren't already disturbing to get any impression of him at all. Her dream refracted at the back of her mind like looking at an image through leaded glass. But there was no sun, only shadows. He sat on an upended wooden pail. He had found a pair of rubber boots, and with a single hand, he held a cigarette burning between his knees. Above his head, a beaten metal lantern hung from the door of the stables, yellow and blurred, barely offering light. She couldn't see his eyes beneath his hat. He had a short russet beard, grown in the manner of most Katakan men, but he didn't feel like most Katakan men. He noticed her. Their sleep. He took a drag from the cigarette. The cherry burned like a microcosm of his own energy, smeared across her awareness.
You're Basuan.
It's so. You come for the dragons. Are you their keeper?
Nah, I'm as kipped as they are.
He shook a leg, and only then did she see the iron shackle around his right ankle, and the chain of it bolted to the wall of the stables. She tried to feel any anger from him. The way any Katakan could expend anger so blunt, it could be discerned without Basuan knowing, but there was none. Only a kind of resignation. The despair from the city sank a little more into her bones. Who's your keeper? The man waved his leather-bound stump vaguely toward the rest of the town. What's their name?
Why?
She set her sack on the ground and shifted the rifle on her shoulder. The man tilted back his chin and regarded her with a faint glimmer of blue eyes. Those eyes marked the two blades at her side. He was not as old as she'd first thought. Perhaps her brother's age. A little older than her. You know Suan, she said. He shrugged. How did you learn Suan? He took another pull from the cigarette.
A feller in the war in my unit. He was Basuan like you.
Some of her people had served, rather than rotting in Katakan camps like her family. None of those volunteers have returned to their ancestral paths after the war. Like the woman in the saloon, they were mired here and employed to wealthy Katakans who sought Basuan skills, but despised the practitioners. She said, what was his name?
Sefehalelela, Janan.
Katakans always said Basuan names backwards. This man did not. I know the family Sefehale. Their path crossed the Darish every summer. Like her family's had. And down across the lesser rivers were now Katakans sifted for gold.
And now they're all scattered to the wind, he said.
A flash of gold shard flickered at her, then dimmed just as quickly. And she realized what she felt from this man was something of the family of Sefehale. As if he'd lived long enough among them to be seen by the stars. What's your name? She said. He flicked the butt of his cigarette toward her. It landed a foot away and snuffed in the mud. He looked into the shadows, and his presence seemed to diffuse as if in search of the gloom. Why are you shackled?
I owe a debt.
A heavy blackness moved on her right. A thick-set Katakan woman in tall rubber boots and a long coat materialized from the dark between the pit dome and the stables. The woman stopped.
Who are you?
This tone of voice like the mountain guard. Meka set her hand on the hilt of one of her blades. I come to ask after this man and the pieball cloud.
Ask what?
How much to buy them out? She felt the man look at her. He moved as if to rise, but stopped when the woman looked his way.
Are you joking? The woman said.
How much? Meka said.
Get out of here, bastard!
Meka lifted her sack and dug into it. Then she tossed a leather bag the size of her hand toward the woman. It landed on the ground, and the contents rang loud.
What the fuck is this?
Meka said. 3 gold bars. You can weigh them. The woman grabbed up the bag and searched inside. lifted out one of the narrow bars, and held it toward the wan lantern light, then up toward the sky as if seeking verification from the moon.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?